It's Thinking Out Loud, KBIA. A couple of guests this evening to talk about the topic of populism in American politics. They're both going to be guests on our campus this week, the 25th of Thursday, in an event sponsored by the Kinder Institute and the American Enterprise Institute. Our guests are Michael Kazin. He is a professor of history at Georgetown University. His most recent book is War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. It's from Simon & Schuster. I understand he's also currently working on a history of the Democratic Party. Our other guest, Henry Olson, is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, one of the nation's most prominent conservative think tanks. His most recent book is called The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue Collar Conservatism, and that is published by Cornell University Press. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate you taking the time. Gentlemen, for starters, I think it's fair to say we have a guest who could be described as more liberal, one that could be described as more conservative. Let's kind of start with some common ground by asking, first of all, a definition of what we mean by populism. Henry, let me give you the first word on that topic.
Yeah, well, I think populism means different things in different eras. Certainly, it takes its name from an era that Michael is intimately familiar with, the pre-World War I era of the Populist Party. Today, I think it generally means a movement by people to retake control of their government against what they perceive to be an out-of-touch elite, whether that is an elite that is bipartisan or elite that is monopartisan.
All right. And Michael, how would you respond to that?
I agree with that somewhat. I think, as Henry said, it's a concept which is contested and has always been contested, even when there was a People's Party. What it stood for was different people had different views of it. I think for my purposes, it's primarily a way of talking about politics, a way of talking about who the people are and why they're basically virtuous and moral and hardworking and patriotic, and who the elite is, which is perceived sometimes as an economic elite, a corporate elite, sometimes as a political elite, sometimes a cultural elite. But it's very much sort of conjures up an idea of the great majority of people have certain common interests as opposed to those of people at the top.
Michael, the most recent printing of your book, The Populist Persuasion, includes silhouettes that are very obviously meant to portray two candidates from the 2016 campaign who had an appeal to populism from very different angles, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. It's interesting that two candidates who on issues were so different in temperament seemed to be quite different and yet kind of fell under that same umbrella in how they approached the campaign.
Right. Well, both of them clearly were running against the, quote, establishment, end quote, in their own parties. They were doing it in different ways. They were both angry, and their voters certainly shared their anger at the establishment. But they had different definitions of the establishment. For Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump was part of that establishment. I mean, he's a very rich man who's been involved with a lot of other rich people around the world. And so for him, for Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump was and is very much a part of the economic elite, which is, according to Sanders and his supporters, injured ordinary people in various ways. But of course, Donald Trump, making a different argument about the swamp, as he called it, running mostly against the political elite, especially that in Washington. But they both, I think, were benefiting from anger among a lot of Americans, which is shared among a lot of people in Europe as well, against a system which seems to have either ignored a lot of the interests of ordinary people or has betrayed them.
Michael Kazin and Henry Olson are guests. Michael, in the book, you make an interesting point early on about how people of very different sides in past elections kind of tried to claim the mantle of following the wishes of the nation's founders. That's a pretty basic foundation of both of our parties, having roots in the founders. Nobody's ever gone wrong politically wrapping themselves up in a Betsy Ross flag. Historically, talk a little bit about how populism has been used.
Wow, well, that's a big question. I think it's used by different political forces for different reasons. Some people say Andrew Jackson was the first populist, and certainly he was the first president, first presidential populist. Certainly he was the first president who did not come from a well-off, well-educated background. But at the same time, you know, if the ordinary people were African American or Native American, he was certainly not their friend.
Yeah.
And in different ways, in the book, I profile different social movements primarily who use the language of populism for very different purposes. For example, the original populists, the People's Party, who gave their name to populism, were very much on the left. They would be considered social democrats today. Bernie Sanders would be quite comfortable, I think, in their company. But then I also argue the prohibitionists saw themselves as representing a moral people against a liquor trust, which was bringing down the morals of ordinary Americans. And of course, the prohibitionists were led by evangelical Protestants, who were then the majority of the population. So they had a certain claim to be representing the people against this immoral elite of liquor dealers and those politicians who did their bidding. So that's a couple examples. I can go on and on, but you know, we'll do more of that, of course,
sure,
next week.
Yeah, and I don't think we should forget that the leader of the populists, not the populist party per se, which was Jim Weaver, but the one who really made the union of the Democratic Party with the populist party, William Jennings Bryan, did so with overtly evangelical language.
Right.
The Cross of Gold speech, which made him the nominee first in 1896 and then two other times subsequently, was an explicit melding of what you might call social democracy and evangelical morality.
Henry, as we talk about populism and how politicians use these ideals and these tactics, your book paints a really intriguing story of how one man brilliantly appealed to what Americans like to call the common man in the older language, or common person, we would say in today's age, President Reagan. Talk a little bit about his brand of populism in a moment, but first, the story talks about President Reagan's upbringing, and he was a solid New Deal Democrat, a liberal by any reasonable definition of his time, and then he would go on to become maybe the conservative icon and Republican icon of this century, still held up as an example by most Republicans that they want to be compared to. Tell me a bit about his evolution and how he got from one spot to another spot over the years.
Yeah, well, Reagan would always say that the Democratic Party left him. He didn't leave the Democratic Party. And what I do in the book is show how that can actually be true, which is to say that Reagan grew up as the one of two children in a very working class family, a dad who was an alcoholic but a functional one, who would regularly lose jobs, but they didn't own a home until Reagan, in his Hollywood days, bought his parents a home in California. Grew up, one of them was Catholic at a time when anti-Catholic discrimination was very high. And so he very much sympathized with the plight of the average person. And that's not something he ever left. That for him, his conservatism included a strong, robust welfare state, not as one as strong as the modern left would want, but one much stronger than the pre-New Deal conservatives or even his friends in National Review would have wanted at the time. And so in that sense, what Ronald Reagan did was reinvent conservatism in Franklin Roosevelt's image.
Michael, in this conversation about the Democratic Party having left him, the turn of the GOP to appealing to blue-collar voters, President Reagan made a statement that absolutely delighted his supporters and outraged a lot of Democrats, believe me, especially here in Missouri, in saying that were he alive today, Harry Truman would be a Republican. From a historical standpoint, how much agreement or disagreement do you have with that thought?
Pretty much 100% disagreement. I mean, I think Harry Truman supported a national health insurance plan in the late 1940s, which was unsuccessful, part because the American Medical Association opposed it, as did, you know, pretty much every Republican. In 1961, when Medicare began to be talked about, when John Kennedy was president, Ronald Reagan gave a famous speech where he said that Medicare would be the first step towards a socialist America. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, if we pass Medicare, our children will not know about a time when America was free. And Harry Truman, when Medicare was signed, Harry Truman was there right next to Lyndon Johnson at the desk and he got the first pen that Johnson signed the Medicare bill with. Mm-hmm. So Harry Truman was a New Deal Democrat, obviously. I mean, he'd been Franklin Roosevelt's vice president, and he would not have been reelected in 1948 if he hadn't had tremendous support from organized labor. And Ronald Reagan, when he became conservative, like most conservatives, was wanted to diminish the power of organized labor. He didn't. He wasn't opposed to, you know, ordinary working people necessarily and their interests, but he didn't think unions were going to be furthering those interests, whereas Harry Truman very much did. So, no, I think, look, politicians like to compare themselves to other earlier popular politicians, and that's something politicians on both the left and the right do. But in this case, I think it was quite inaccurate.
Harry Truman's still a popular guy, like I said, especially here in Missouri, so you can't go wrong aligning with him. Michael Kazin, one of our guests. He is a professor of history at Georgetown. Henry Olson, also with us, the senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Henry, there are such massive issues that changed so dramatically in the era we're talking about. But I want to get your take on something that paints kind of an interesting picture of the difference in approach to the role of government during the Reagan era that all of us of a certain age remember. Talk about government cheese.
Government cheese. Oh, gosh. Okay, so...
I heard that one for a while.
I know exactly what you're talking about. So at the time that Reagan was president, starting with the New Deal, one of the ways to intervene in the market to prop up the incomes of farmers was to buy surpluses. It's not a thing that's done anymore, but what you would do is you would encourage production and the government would buy surplus. And at one point, because the milk market was weak, the government had so much cheese that it then started giving it away to people. That was in the middle or early part of the middle of 1980s. And Reagan, one thing Reagan was always opposed to was agriculture, not opposed to when he was a New Dealer, but opposed to in a conservative era, was exactly that idea of government mandating production quotas and trying to manipulate markets in such a way as create artificial surpluses or deficits.
And to clarify, that was not limited to agricultural. When you say opposed to government in the markets, that was true pretty much across the board, right?
Well, it depends what you mean by that, and that's what my book tries to show, is that, you know, Ronald Reagan was a free trader who also slapped tariffs on goods from Japan, China, and other, and Canada even, when he felt that they were competing unfairly. This is something that, you know, now today we have Donald Trump doing that, and he's decried by free marketeers as being unfair, you know, as improperly intervening in markets. Ronald Reagan had no problem with that. So what Reagan had a problem with all throughout was government direction and government control. He actually did not have a problem with limited targeted government intervention. And that's the distinction I make in my book, which separates him both from many of his hagiographers today and many of his right-wing contemporaries at the time.
I am delighted to spend as much time as we could possibly get before we all drop from exhaustion talking about history, but let's talk about a more modern light. The obvious appeal to voters, very much as Ronald Reagan did, who might in the past have been solid Democrats, lower income or lower middle income white voters, union people to some degree, of Donald Trump in places like West Virginia. I'd like to get both of you in on that. Let's, Michael, start with you.
Well, actually, I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal right after the election in 2016, you know, trying to understand why places like West Virginia went from being about a solid Democratic state in the country, really up until the 1990s, and now is one of the most solid Republican places in the country. And I think a lot of that has to do with the decline of unions. The United Mine Workers used to have something like 150,000 members in West Virginia. Now they have about 20,000 members, and half of those are retirees. And, you know, the union really sort of educated people to support liberal programs, to support liberal politicians, to support pro-labor politicians. But when the union declined, people were, first of all, they didn't have as good jobs anymore. They took more drugs. Some people went to church more than they had before, especially more conservative churches. And so I think folks like that were turned to conservatism because that was how they were learning about politics, from their churches, from Fox News. I'm oversimplifying the situation. There's a lot of cultural issues, of course, which the Democratic Party embraced, like pro-choice and marriage equality, which a lot of religious people didn't like either. But also, I think it's important to realize that people learn about politics through institutions they're part of, whether they're groups of friends or colleges or churches or unions. And the most important sort of liberal democratic institution in West Virginia was not the Democratic Party, it was the union.
And then, Henry, your thoughts on that. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a union man. He had been a union leader when he was with the Screen Actors Guild.
Right. No, I mean, he was always somebody who liked to say he was the only union president. Remit to this day, it's the only union president ever holding the office of the presidency. I think one thing is the decline of the unions is also a result of the decline of the coal industry. The coal industry increasingly has been in decline for a long time. You know, the war on coal that you hear Trump talk about has been intermittent and long-standing. So it's not just that the union weakened, it's that the industry weakened.
Of course.
What essentially happened in West Virginia was that people moved from a union identity to a evangelical identity, but not necessarily with changing their domestic politics. I terribly doubt that any Republican office holder in West Virginia will go running around cutting black lung disability payments to the miners there, no matter how many times the Wall Street Journal might call it waste and fraud. And it should be noted that Ronald Reagan never carried West Virginia, and West Virginia maintained its union status during 20 years of the rise of the religious right. What really tips it over is the Bush election. That's the first time that West Virginia goes Republican in a contested election since the creation of the UMW.
Yeah, and I actually there's a closer to home in Missouri example of the same phenomenon, which is that, as you know, Republicans have been carrying Missouri for a while now, not in every election, but obviously presidential elections. But recently, there was the vote about the right to work in Missouri, which lost overwhelmingly, I think 65% opposing it, and including a lot of people who voted for Trump opposed it.
Well, and it's been
And the thing I want to—I should also note that Ronald Reagan, through most of his career, he only changed the support right to work by 1980. He was opposed to right to work ostentatiously when he was running for governor.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. There's a letter in 1970 where he writes to the right to work president explaining why he opposes right to work, because he supports compulsory unionism. And so that again shows how Reagan at his heart understood what the touchstones were for the workers of the genuine New Deal coalition.
Bring back that Ronald Reagan, I say.
Henry Olson.
I wrote the book to try and do that, Michael.
good.
Michael Kazin, Henry Olson with us again. They're going to be on campus Thursday, the 25th. It'll be at 5:30 in the Palmer Room of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. The event being co-sponsored by the Kinder Institute here on the Mizzou campus and the American Enterprise Institute. You can keep up with what Kinder Institute is doing at democracy.missouri.edu. Michael, we mentioned Senator Sanders. We mentioned what happened with Donald Trump, and it was fascinating to watch what one of the other major players in this 2016 election had involved. There's a lot of friction going on now within the Democratic Party, and it's way too cheap and easy to write it off as the Hillary people versus the Bernie people, although a lot of people both inside and outside of the party kind of look at it that way. A lot of younger voters and a lot of people that just reject very soundly what you guys both referred to earlier as the elite, the establishment. And if you think of a dictionary definition of Democratic establishment, Hillary Clinton's picture would be right there.
Yep. this is a longer discussion, but, you know, I think there's the period that historians call the New Deal Order period, which lasted pretty much up till Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, began during the Great Depression when Franklin Roosevelt was first elected in 1932. you know, it was a pretty unusual period in American history, because it was a period where most Americans did trust the government to do the right thing, wanted to do the right thing, and programs to enlarge the welfare state were pretty popular, new programs especially. I think, you know, what's happened in the last 40, 45 years, and there's been a lot of talk about this, is even when we've had prosperous times like the early 90s and like now in the larger economy, a lot of people feel they're not gaining from it. There's, of course, a lot of fear about immigrants out there taking people's jobs, doing away with people's culture. And I think there's a lot of young people, whether on the left or the right, I think have grown up at a time of tremendous insecurity. And even if they go to college, like University of Missouri, you know, when they get out, they're not sure what kind of career they're going to have. Maybe they can't have one career that's secure. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, why, even though the macroeconomy is doing very well right now, low unemployment rate and so forth, there's still a lot of unhappiness out there. And young people also, you know, tend not to believe what politicians are telling them, most of them anyway, because they feel politicians have not really been serving their interests in recent years. So, you know, but it's a crisis, I think, which has been brewing really arguably since the 1970s.
Henry, I'm enjoying this conversation a lot. We've got people with different ideas, and nobody's called anybody any names, and nobody's gotten angry or raised their voices at one another. And I know that, again, this may be an oversimplification, but it seemed like there was a time where this was a much more easy conversation for people to have. I remember my grandfather sitting over the back fence while he was working on his tomato gardens and talking to the gentleman next door, who was ironically enough named Mr. Nixon. And my papa was an old Southern Democrat and Mr. Nixon was a Republican, and they'd sit there and they'd argue about whatever political issues were going on, and then they'd talk about what was going on with church or their grandkids or whatever, and they'd be good friends and shake hands, and that would be the end of it. It seemed like in this last election, and really just kind of in recent times, it's getting harder and harder for people to find a way to have a civil conversation with somebody they disagree with on some of this stuff.
Yeah, now that is increasingly a huge problem. And you know, I wrote an article about this for an English website recently that cites data that says that about half of members of each party both hate the members of the other party, you know, not dislike or distrust, hate. And about half think that the other party's policies are not only misguided, but are a threat to the country. And so when you, that still leaves, you know, half of the people who can have this conversation, but they are disempowered half because they're minorities within their own party and the independents have no party, and they can't find a voice in public affairs.
Michael, that would call for the possibility of at least thinking of a third party. Is the two-party system as we have it now in trouble? What's good about it? What's not?
I think third parties, as Henry knows, in American history, have usually sort of been like meteors. You know, they enlighten the landscape politically for a while and bring new issues to the fore, but then they never last. Usually only about one presidential campaign do they last, sometimes a little longer. You know, there's all kinds of reasons for that I can go into, but no, I think the two parties are here to stay. I think what's going on is there's a battle within each party, actually, about what the party's going to stand for. President Trump pretty much is now defining what Republicans stand for, but there's a lot of Republicans who were very much in favor of what George W. Bush was doing. Well, not always, not everything he was doing, but a lot of things he was doing, and liked his kind of compassionate conservatism, who now are very much opposed to him, to Trump, and a lot of his policies. And the Democratic Party, as you say, there's splits too. But I think, you know, we've been through this kind of thing before in some ways. We had a civil war, after all,
yeah.
In which a lot of Democrats did not acknowledge that that Abraham Lincoln had been fairly elected president, and they left the Union because of it. In the 1960s, when I was in college, was a time of tremendous conflict, not necessarily between the parties, but between, you know, different social groups and different ideologies, and there was a lot more violence that accompanied those differences back in the 60s than there is now. So, you know, we go through periods like this, and they don't last. But they do, I think, have consequences. And in the end, too, I mean, I believe in civility very much, and, you know, I'm a teacher, and I have to I empathize with whatever my students say and my colleagues say, whether I agree with them or not. But I think also these conflicts usually end with one side winning or another side losing. And I think we're more likely for that to happen in one way or another than to have some sort of compromise.
Well, I enjoyed very much both spending some time with The Populist Persuasion by Mr. Kazin and Henry Olson's book. Again, it is titled The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of the Blue-Collar Conservatism. As a politician, a politics buff and a history buff, they were both very interesting reads. They will both be on campus. Once again, it's going to be happening Thursday, the 25th, and that's co-sponsored by the Kinder Institute and the American Enterprise Institute. It'll be at 5:30. At RJI in the Palmer Room. And again, if you want to find out more, democracy.missouri.edu is the website for the Kinder Institute. Henry Olson from the Ethics and Public Policy Center and Michael Kazin from Georgetown, thank you both so much. You've been really generous with your time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.